I'm here with Rebecca Roth, and I know you just released your fifth book in the Methodical series. And so you basically become an author, and that wasn't your original plan. So I'd like to go back and just kind of explore this methodical timeline, because all of your books are named Methodical something or other. And so I'd like to know exactly how you managed to put these books together and what was the impetus for these books being put together. So let's start with Methodical Illusion, which was the first book. And it's been a while since I've read it, but I think it was published in 2015 or 16.
I think it was came out in November 2014.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I mean, and it seems like it'd been a while.
Yeah, I think if I remember, I'm not positive either. It's been such a whirlwind. I think I was on Coast to Coast in March of 2015, and that's when it took off.
Well, that was the only book you were going to write, correct?
Yeah, it's true. I never thought I'd be a Pulitzer Prize winner.
That wasn't in the cards.
Just sort of retire, be a grandma, do some gardening, have some cats. I didn't. But what happened, I think, well, first off, when I was still flying, it was really a difficult thing to look at without seeing the official story, even though the official story didn't really make sense. And there were many details of it that seemed impossible. And I've chatted with several flight attendants and pursers that felt the same way. And it wasn't until they were no longer on the line flying that they could stop and think clearly and look at the truth. And a lot of them actually have read the books and then contacted me. And of course, in the airline, we're all one big family. And it's actually because of that one big family that a lot of stuff came my way. So a lot of flight attendants, pilots, ground people, all kinds of people, air traffic controllers, that eventually started contacting me with information that they had, and in some cases, information they had that they actually feared our government of finding out that they had. So I became a repository, I guess, in a way, for information. Well, I first discovered that 7 or 10 of the accused hijackers were actually still alive. That kind of encouraged me to take my first look at this a little closer, because I was like, well, how did they live through those 4 events that they showed us on television? So that kind of encouraged me to look. And once I started doing that, I started to see other things. And then people just sort of gravitated to me that happened to be there. And sometimes I wrote them into the books as characters and just changed their identity. But I actually had met, by chance, a Special Forces soldier who was on the lawn of the Pentagon on 9/11, we all saw those people look like they were looking for a contact lens, looking for plane parts, right, on the grass. But he reassured me there was no 757 that crashed into that building.
Well, I know you have become a repository for 9/11 information, and you've received information from all over the world from various people that have seen or known or have done things that were involved with 9/11. Why do you suppose that is? I mean, there have been a lot of people in the airline industry that have made comments about 9/11 and this, that, and the other, but you really are the only one that have continued to study and dig and basically give the information in your various books. Why do you suppose you're the one that does that? And no, but none of the rest of them have.
I don't know. I don't have an answer to that other than there is this sisterhood or family bond between all airline people. So when 9/11 happened, it happened to our family, whether we worked for that airline involved or not, which is the case a lot of times. But this one in particular, was that way. And a lot of people saw things and heard things that were abnormal. They were not the way they normally happened, whether that was, for example, in a normal crash or airplane incident, call it an accident, FBI is not involved. In a normal circumstance, the FAA and then the National Transportation Safety Board does the investigation along with the FAA. If they find, you know, cocaine or some illegal arms, or, you know, if they find something in the investigation part, the National Transportation Safety Board then would contact the FBI. In the case of 9/11, the FBI took all of the air traffic control tapes, all of the evidence immediately. And so before anybody really knew anything, and I happen to have this in documentation, the FBI was involved collecting data. So one of the things that happened for me in the first book in Methodical Illusion, mainly because of my experience in the airline, I knew that cell phones didn't work, and they still don't. And
well, I was just going to say, you know, when you wrote Methodical Illusion, it was so different than anything that had been put out before that. And it flew in the face of the official story. And I think perhaps that's one of the reasons you became the repository, because people knew you weren't afraid to tell the truth. And even though these people had aspects of the truth, they were afraid to tell it, but they weren't afraid to tell you. And I think that's why you receive so much information.
Quite possible. I was the craziest one to put it out there. But thank God I put it out in novel form, or I probably wouldn't be alive today. Looking back now to when I did write this and I chose to use a novel form, self-preservation wasn't my idea. I actually thought that it would be easier for people to comprehend and digest the truth if they read it as a novel. Because if you saw this whole thing play out in a movie, you could believe it. If you see something in a book like that, you hopefully will be able to believe it. Because as things are continuing to unfold now, 6-7 years later, I think we're starting to see now the reality that we were blind to on September 11th, 2001. But back to what I was saying, I knew that in 2001, you know, if you'll remember, we were using those little, you know, cell phones that were kind of like the size of a cigarette package, like Nokia phones.
Well, they were analog.
Analog phones. They didn't work. Even in an aluminum airplane at an airport, you could hardly get a one single bar of connection. So even today, and I have somebody that contacts me every trip they make out of a major, major city in the United States, they still, at the first 3 to 5 seconds of flight, they lose their cell reception. Now, you can get on an airplane today in 2011 or 2021 and get on Wi-Fi signal, you know, pay extra and be able to text message and stuff like that. But I'm talking a straight cell phone call. You cannot make one. There may be a chance if you're, you know, under 2,000 feet, maybe for about a split second or two. there's a chance, but my friend tries every trip and text messages me on the layover. You know, like once we get to 1,800 feet or 2,000 feet, thereabouts, there's no cell reception. Still.
Well, you know,
20 years later,
the thought just occurred to me that it was important to have cell connection in and amongst the people in the United States in order to pull this off. They couldn't have done it in 1995 or 1990 because people didn't really have cell phones to that extent. At least they didn't have portable cell phones. So by 2001, when people had it, they were able to pull this thing up, because it was very important that cell phones were used in the official story to pull at people's heartstrings and to describe what it was that happened. I mean, if it really had been Arab hijackers in the planes that crashed, nobody would have known. if they'd have pulled this off in 1985.
Well, that's true. And we also had, except for Flight 77, we also had airphones on board. And so the interesting thing about that is that the FBI's official story initially, and you can actually, you can Google search all of these things and find initial stories, but a lot of them they've gone back and reworked. That's why it's important to turn everything into a PDF and save it in a file or print it off. But a PDF is a really good thing if you find information you're looking for. Don't just think it's going to be on the internet, because the FBI's gone back and rewritten history. And a lot of those calls that they claimed were cell phone calls were not cell phone, and they were not airphone calls either. There were no activated airphones on Americans' 757s at that time. They had deactivated all their phones. So you'll remember Ted Olson talking about 4 phone calls from Barbara Olson that she called collect from a cell phone. You couldn't do that. You had to swipe a credit card. They were very expensive. So then he tried. Then he said she called collect from her cell phone. Well, you've never been able to do that. Again, initially, when we had the early cell phones, it was extremely expensive with roaming charges and very little coverage. Certainly not going to get coverage from altitude on an airplane. So she obviously had a problem with truth. That man did. But it's interesting now, because looking back, and I found so many documents over this last decade, that the FBI changed their story so much and tried to say, well, they didn't call from a cell phone. They called from an airphone, a seat back pocket of the airplane, and blah, blah, blah. But people had caller ID on their home phone a lot that time. And some of them, either the phones had it or there was a little device and it would tell you who was calling. So when Tom Burnett called his wife, it said Tom's cell. And when Peter Hansen called his dad, his caller ID said Peter's cell.
So if you called from an airphone, it wouldn't say airphone flight 11 or 77. It wouldn't say that, right?
No. So, but they did actually mention, and a lot of this is still in their FBI 302 interviews, that these people called from a cell phone, from their cell phone. One woman on Flight 93 had borrowed a cell phone and called the person, her friend that she'd borrowed the phone from, to tell him that, you know, she was on a flight with an incident. And used his cell phone, and then she gave it to someone else to use. Again, there's no way that looking at this from a flight attendant's point of view, there was no way that those cell phone calls could be made. And initially, almost every call that supposedly was made from the plane supposedly was from a cell phone. So one of the things that caught my eye, and I think a lot of people don't know this, and again, this is just because of my airline career. So I don't have bunions for no good reason, right? Is that when Betty Ong on Flight 11, which was the first flight to be supposedly hijacked, she made a comment that led me to believe, and I kind of believed this at the time of writing Methodical Illusion, that they had maybe 3 to 5 years prior to 9/11, been selling to the commercial airlines in the United States a flight termination system, which was a remote control system, and quote, to be used in the event of a hijacking and a hijacker were to take over the cockpit, we could land the plane remotely. Well, both American and United had those. The flight termination system allowed someone to remotely land the airplane. You're probably asking yourself now, why didn't they do that on 9/11 when they knew there were supposedly people that had been into the cockpit that weren't supposed to be there? Why didn't they use the flight termination system? And that is a good question, because that's not really what was going on. That's the answer. But it took me a long time to find that answer. But what happened was, when Betty Ong said the pilots are not answering their interphone, when you call from jump seat to the cockpit, that phone line wasn't working. They were not answering. And just so you know, when the flight termination system was activated and somebody was taking over your plane remotely, this was a flaw, and this is why some airlines did not accept the flight termination system, was that there would be no communication between the cabin, the flight attendants, and the cockpit. And in order to successfully end a hijacking, it was really important that we could speak to the pilots because we're their eyes and ears, and it would be in the cabin that a hijacker would first show up. He was not going to first show up in the cockpit. So we had code words to use to contact the pilot. So what when she said that they weren't answering their phone, initially I thought, well, somebody had remotely taken over the plane. A bunch of pilots contacted me along the way throughout this book series and reconfirmed that that probably wasn't the case, that they would actually have needed the pilots to steer the planes into the hangars.
Well, you know, one of the other things that you really revealed in Methodical Illusion was the fact that the planes went someplace other than where the media has told us or showed us or explained to us went. How did you come upon that? How did you figure out that the planes went someplace else?
Well, that's interesting. And again, that goes back to the cell phone calls. And when I started gathering data, and a lot of it was government data on the story, the government's rendition of how everything happened, FBI documents and this and that sort of thing, I knew the phone calls couldn't have been made from cell phones. So I kind of kept track of who said what, on what kind of phone did they use. And then all of that information, I lined it up with, wait a minute now. But Betty Ong really informed me by saying one thing. She said that he, referring to just one hijacker, not five, that he had sprayed pepper spray or mace in business class up front and toward the cockpit, and they couldn't breathe up there. But she was in the aft section at door three on the right-hand side, and she wasn't having any problems. She stayed on the phone for nearly a half an hour, never complained about the effects of pepper spray or mace. And I knew from my own training, and then later on from actually an experience, that if you spray something like pepper spray, mace, even if you use fingernail polish or fingernail polish remover, or a baby gets real sick or has a really stinky diaper, the smell goes through the whole airplane. So pepper spray and mace, which later on actually happened on a flight from California to Hawaii, would affect everyone on board. Any hijacker, the pilots, all of the crew members would be suffering from the effects. And when it happened on that flight several years back between California and Hawaii, once the plane landed, more than a dozen passengers and crew members were taken to a hospital. That's how sick they were throughout the entire cabin, including the cockpit. So that statement that she made me go back and read through all the comments and all the FBI 302s that I could find about her taped conversation, and everyone I found was just a little bit different. So they took things out of there, like he stood upstairs. There are no stairs on a 767, but there are stairs in hangars, large hangars. And so there were clues in there. She said, we're the first. How would she have known that? I mean, there hadn't been a hijacking since like 1970 in the United States. So how would she know that unless someone told her the plan for the day? So I started to see all these details that a flight attendant wouldn't say, I don't know, we might be being hijacked, we're up in the air. Well, a hijacking only takes place once you're in the air, because if somebody while you were on the ground tried to take over your airplane, the pilots just wouldn't take off. And we just arm the chutes and open the doors and shove everybody out the slides. So that would be a successful ending to a hijack attempt on the ground, right? Wouldn't be very successful for the hijacker. So I started to look at stuff in a very detailed fashion like that. And then because I had flown out of Boston. I knew the time of the phone calls. I started to do, and I actually walked the reader through this. If you go to a site, website called airplanemanager.com, there's a flight calculator, and it can tell you exactly what kind of aircraft, if you're in a heavy, this where these were, the wide body jet or 757, 767. You could do seasonal wind, no wind, light winds, whatever. And it can tell you how far it is, how long it takes to fly from A to B. And then I started following planes on Flight Radar 24 to see how long does it take to get from Boston Logan to the nearest 10,000-foot runway, which I did find on Google Earth. And in that research, I found out that the Westover Air Force Base was a reserve base. Later on, I found out it had been completely evacuated by all personnel that day or before that, and that they had over a 10,000-foot runway. I think it's 11,005 feet or something along that line. And I knew that a 767 loaded with fuel could still land heavy, but it was going to need a long runway. So that kind of fit the bill. Once I found Westover Air Force Base and I realized that Flight 11 and 175 out of Boston could have landed there, and then the phone calls were made, then I did that same thing with the flight from Newark and the flight from Dulles, and the timing from the time they land to the time a phone call was made from those flights was right on and actually made me sick. I couldn't go back and look. It was, uh-oh. Then I knew. Then I knew why all of this didn't make sense, because it wasn't true. So that kind of started me going on realizing what we were told and shown wasn't near as horrific as the truth. So I kind of kept on going. And after I did an interview with George Noory on Coast to Coast AM, I got contacted by other people that were eyewitnesses for the landings at Westover and other people.
But, you know, these people that saw these planes, at the time, it didn't make any sense to them.
That's true.
They would see commercial airplanes, but they were more concerned about what was going on in New York and Washington, D.C. and Shanksville. I mean, it just didn't make any sense. But when you came out on Coast to Coast and said what you said, then all of a sudden it came back to them. Oh, yeah, that's what that plane was. Now that explains mm-hmm. what I saw. And so you really not only did the world a service, you did them a service.
Right. Some of the people that contacted me that had seen that were so certain that by the time they got out of their appointment they were headed off to, that they would be told that a commercial, large commercial aircraft had crashed just up the road from where they were in Western Massachusetts. And when they got out of their appointment, they found out that there had been Shanksville and the Pentagon and the Twin Towers. And they're like, no way. No way could that airplane. It was too close to the ground. So they were like, no, it probably didn't make it 5 miles away from me. It had to have crashed here in Western Massachusetts. So once they contacted me, was like, I just can't thank you enough for everybody thought I was crazy because what, and I thought I was crazy because this airplane would not have made it to New York. It was just so low to the ground, they could see the windows and people inside. And
well, how many eyewitnesses came forward and contacted you?
I've had a few. One of them was a retired FBI agent that was out walking some dogs. Now, when she noticed that, because her father actually had been in the military, so she'd been used to seeing commercial planes land, and we do... I even did some military contract flying or craft flying where civilian commercial airplanes and crew are hired by the government to move refugees or troops. So it's not uncommon to see a commercial plane. And when she saw it that morning, she thought, well, some bigwigs from Washington are just flying in or there's some kind of troop movement. It's just not that abnormal. But again, she heard an interview and went, oh my gosh, that's what I saw. And it was the airlines involved. So that interview One, it shot Methodical Illusion up into the top 10 on Amazon Books. That's how many people heard that Coast to Coast interview. And a lot of people came forward with a lot of information. And I became privy then to nearly a terabyte of Freedom of Information Act data, which was a lot of radar in text files. One of the files I found that was very interesting to me as I was going through this, and it's really a huge file. A lot of things are unmarked or mismarked or not what you think they are if you to read the title. But one of the things that I found in the MP3 voice files was an interesting file, because when for some reason I clicked on the meta tags, the metadata that's connected to this MP3 file, and I found that it was titled terrorist, which struck me very weird because in aviation we only dealt with hijackers. And so I thought, well, that's kind of odd. And then I looked down, and this was uploaded to the FAA headquarters in Washington, D.C.'s computer system, and it was copyrighted and titled terrorist. But then the clincher. I looked down, and the time it was uploaded to the Washington, D.C. headquarters of the FAA was 6:37 a.m. on 9/11/2001. And they didn't even supposedly have this file. This file supposedly was in Boston Center in Nashua, New Hampshire. But the terrorist, quote, quote, didn't make that statement until, according to their story, 8:24. But wait, there's more. He wasn't even on the plane in real life. So when I saw that, though, I still believe that there were 19 radicalized Muslims on board. But I thought, well, that's kind of odd. Did they have him pre-record this? Because it was into the Washington, D.C. FAA headquarters file an hour and a half before that plane even took off. How did that work? So now, yes, I'm sure that some real hacker could maybe go in and change the meta tag on a file, but wait, there was another file. And same story. So I'm pretty sure nobody changed that, and I'm pretty sure they thought nobody would look at the metadata on an MP3 file. But again, that encouraged me to keep on looking, because this wasn't the official story.
Well, I remember once you mentioned the fact that you found a file that was in the trash.
Yeah, that's an interesting file. This is September 11th, Trash, it's called. And inside there, I found the flight plan and the time of departure for an aircraft, an old 707, 320, I think it's a 320, old Boeing 707 aircraft called the Speckled Trout. And on board that aircraft was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Hugh Shelton. He ended up writing a book. It's very interesting. And yeah, when I read it, I wondered to myself, well, why is he lying about where he was and when he was? Because I had his flight plan from the trash file that didn't get trashed. It got put into the FOIA data. And so there was a lot of things there. The connecting flight from Portland, Maine was there, so I knew it wasn't really late. So there was no excuse for Mohammed Atta's luggage to not make the flight. And then I found out from American Airlines flight attendants that Mohammed Atta was a million-mile flyer. Well, in order to do that, he would have had to flown almost every day since the time he got here on June 3rd, 2000. So that didn't make any sense either. So it's interesting, though, with my second book, Methodical Deception, I had the FOIA data, the radar text files, the terrorist-labeled MP3 file that was uploaded an hour and a half before departure on Flight 11. And then I found an interesting DEA report. It had eventually surfaced online, and I found this DEA report, and it was about traveling artists that were going to federal employees' homes and businesses and trying to sell cheap copies of art from that they'd purchase in China for $10 and try to sell it for $200 or $300. But what they were doing, they were going to Air Force bases U.S. Marshals homes and offices, and offices that were not public knowledge of the fact that there was a DEA office in there or some other U.S. government, maybe NSA or contractor for an NSA or something, but they were not publicly known to be that. And some of these artists were traveling with blueprints of the base or the buildings they were involved in, and they claimed they were from Israel. And so in this DEA report, it's about a 66-page report, and there's a link to that off the methodicaldeception.com website. But I found it very interesting, and I later on was connected to someone who was one of the DEA agents involved in that story. So I got a little bit more inside story about other things that they were involved in. One of the things they did was they said they were selling these copies of art for, now I don't know if they had listening devices in them. They were framed, I believe. So I don't know what could have been there for as far as the espionage goes, because the interesting story was they told one particular gentleman that they were selling this art to make money for school, for this art school, and they gave him the name of the art school, and he went online and looked for it, and as the U.S. Marshal that he was, there was no such school in Israel at all, anywhere. So then he started to alert other people, and this kind of all went out from the DEA, which is kind of an interesting story, and I included a lot of that kind of story in the second book. So I try to bring in all the information that comes to me and build it into the character's experience and what happens.
Well, I'm really curious about this FOIA hard drive you had with a terabyte of information on it. As I understand it, it was a lot of flight control data and radar data and that kind of stuff. And I don't know how a flight attendant was able to decipher that. How'd you figure it out?
Well, it's an interesting timing because when I was really digging into this, it's just a huge file of cluster. And I really just kind of asked for help. And lo and behold, I got contacted by someone who had a friend who had heard an interview that said, you got to contact this flight attendant who's written these books. And he ended up being an air traffic controller with a very interesting military and intelligence background. He was air traffic controller at Edwards Air Force Base, and he was a military liaison to Area 51. And he was kind of curious because I'd mentioned Promise Software and P-Tech, a company, in my earlier books and wanted to know how did I know that. But one of the interesting stories he had was that in a Russian-made Antonov aircraft had been coming into Mojave Boneyard Airport, Air and Spaceport, I think they refer to it now, with loads of gold in the weeks prior to 9/11. So everybody was wondering what happened to all the gold that was in the vaults underneath the towers. And so once we started getting together and we had these lengthy Skype conversations and sharing these files from all of the data, I'm into book three now. And we discovered not just did the gold from this Russian Antonov come in multiple weeks before, but they were given restricted airspace clearance. And like he was like, wait a minute, not even the president of the United States is going to get clearance to fly there. But they would fly through this restricted airspace around Edwards Air Force Base, land at the Mojave airport, offload this gold. And one of his friends actually went and photographed this. And this car, it was a big cargo plane, a Russian cargo aircraft. So then he didn't understand that until after 9/11 happened. Then word started coming out that the vaults had been found emptied, mostly emptied. There was one truck that had broken down, broken axle or something, trying to escape with a lot of gold on it that they found after the towers fell. So, but most of the vaults were basically emptied, and so putting two and two together, and we started going through all this stuff. We also found on a FOIA request that somebody else had done, but I found it online, that medevac planes had flown into Andrews Air Force Base late that night, around 9 o'clock or so. And medevac planes are basically airplane hospitals. They can carry certain number of hospital beds or cots, or just bodies basically in body bags stacked up. And the amount of interesting thing, because of his background in military and Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia and all, basically it worked out to just roughly the number of people that probably were killed at Westover. And we just assumed that all military bases do have a incinerator of some sort, so they probably took care of the bodies that way. Just our guess, because we, of course, weren't there, but we did find these DC-9s, and there was no need for a DC-9 medevac plane to come into Andrews Air Force Base that night. There wasn't any, because the Pentagon people, they didn't have to fly in. They are just 20 minutes away by ambulance. So there was no reason for a medevac planes to be brought in that night. They weren't finding bodies at the towers or in Shanksville, and both in New York and Shanksville are not all that close to Andrews. So there was no explanation for that. It was just some surmised on our part that that's probably what they did with the bodies.
Well, one of my favorite accounts in Methodical Conclusion, which of course is the third book that you wrote, was this gentleman that was at the Pentagon on the morning. He'd flown in for a meeting with somebody in the Pentagon. And, you know, of course, all heck broke loose. But his story is fascinating. Can you recount that?
That is a fascinating story. We had several conversations about it, too. He was at one of the hotels. I don't remember. It might have been a Hilton. Just don't recall the exact name of it. It's right across the street from the Pentagon. And it was interesting because there was an explosion, but no aircraft. He actually heard people on the phone that were in military uniforms, like generals and officers, that were talking, and everybody referred to it as an explosion. No one ever mentioned an airplane. So he went out and he was looking and saw this, and he tried to rent a car because he realized now this was the third, that both the towers had been hit. He learned that in the hotel lobby. And the Pentagon had just been hit. So he knew that a person he was meeting was probably not going to be at this meeting, and that something bad was happening in America. So he needed to get home. There were no rental cars already. So he managed to, I guess, at a rental car place, and somebody was returning a car, and he made a deal to this person at a rental car that he could rent her car and pay her bill and all this. So he managed to get a car and drove home. I believe he was in Kentucky or someplace. And he drove home. It mentioned this, you know, of course, to his boss. And his boss actually misunderstood what he had seen. And somehow his boss had some connection to someone at the Pentagon or in the CIA. And his company actually did do security on the Pentagon. It was one of their contracts, but it wasn't his contract. So his boss misunderstood this and somehow managed to talk to a couple men in black that demanded to see him. They sent a corporate jet to his nearest airport, to his home, picked him up and flew him up to the Midwest to the corporate offices. And these two men in black suits, the men in black really, came in. And they sat down in a conference, just him and them, and they showed him a video of some sort on some type of device that was a missile hitting the Pentagon in high definition, some of the highest, clearest definition he said he'd ever seen. And they said to him, "Is this what you saw?" And he said, "I'm afraid there's been a misunderstanding. I didn't see anything. There was just an explosion. I didn't see anything." Needless to say, he had some employment problems after that, that were something only a very dark force could bring to anybody. Misunderstanding by his boss led them to believe that he had seen the missile hit the Pentagon. So there's a lot of things going on here around the Pentagon that came out in the FOIA data, also that came into methodical conclusion of a potential site for a missile to be launched. Different things that worked into that book about that area having highways closed down and Fort Belvoir being closed down to traffic, and I believe it still is. So there's a lot of interesting stuff that works out through there, along with some information about China Lake. And I think a lot of people know a little bit more about China Lake now. We had a bunch of earthquakes up there a few years back, and it's a place where they do a lot of testing for experimental aircraft and weaponry. So there, I got a lot of information from that. And my friend said, I hope this isn't top secret anymore. I hope this isn't classified anymore. I said, me too, because, you know, it's great stuff. But again, you know, I decided to write all this as novels, and you get to choose whether you want to believe it or not. But someone said to me after the second or third book, these are not fiction, they're faction. These are books that are literally created by true to life, real information and documentation from our government and from employees and others that saw things, were places, and had no place else to go.
Well, speaking of no place else to go, I think when you wrote that third book, the reason you titled it Methodical Conclusion is because you thought you were done and you had nothing left to do. Is that correct?
That's true. That is true. So that is exactly why I chose Methodical Conclusion as the title. I thought it was all finished. I thought it was finished, and then Exposure and Agenda came along. And one more will come after Agenda. And then that should be it. I keep saying that. When I was writing a little note, a note from the author or something in the back of this agenda, I had looked at a couple of the other books, and I kept saying, well, this is the last book I'm going to write. But this time I said, no, this isn't the last book I'm going to write. So there will be one more.
So this, what you've said so far, is going to conclude the methodical timeline, part one, and we'll be back later with part two.
Sounds like a plan.